Good morning, everyone. I now call this remote meeting of the House Climate and Energy Finance and Policy Committee to order, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Long.
Present.
Vice Chair Akam.
Present.
Minority Lead Swazinski.
Present.
Representative Bierman.
Present.
Representative Bowe.
Present.
Representative Christensen.
Present.
Representative Franson.
Present.
Representative Grunhagen.
Present.
Representative Hollins.
Present.
Representative Hornstein.
Present.
Representative Igo.
Present.
Representative Lee.
Lee present.
Representative Lippert.
Present.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard present.
Representative Mecklen.
Present.
Representative Munson.
Present.
Representative Stevenson.
Present.
Perfect attendance. Well, great. We have a quorum. So today we have three different segments, and we'll be taking questions after each of those. Our first segment will be a presentation from our Department of Commerce on the Federal Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act and the sections relevant to energy. And we will be hearing one of my bills on making some technical fixes on the Prairie Island Net Zero Project. Finally, we'll hear a presentation from the Center for Sustainable Building Research on the Construction Materials Environmental Impact Report. But first, we are going to be welcoming the Department of Commerce and Assistant Commissioner Catherine Blauvelt and the Director of the State Energy Office, Michelle Grancy. I don't know who will start, but looks like before we start, Representative Swazinski has a question. So, Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Chairman Long. Just a quick question on the what's your thinking for your bill that we'll be hearing today? You know, I encourage you, it's pretty non-controversial fix from what I could see, and I would just encourage you to make the motion to put it on the general register. So I'm not sure what your plan is, but that's all I had to say. Thanks.
Thank you, Representative Swazinski. Yes, that is my intent, is to move it for the general register, and I'm hoping that that can be an easy fix we can get done early this session. All right. With that, I will turn it over to the Department of Commerce and whomever would like to take it away.
Thank you, Chair Long, members, for this opportunity to share and present information today. State Energy Office Director Michelle Grancy and I will share presenting responsibilities. So I'll start. My name again is Catherine Blauvelt. I'm Assistant Commissioner for the Division of Energy Resources. I have a number of responsibilities. I'm part of a leadership team within Commerce that creates our policy and budget proposals. I also oversee our energy assistance program, our siting program, telecommunications, and our State Energy Office Director and I are co-leading on this sizable effort to track and hopefully maximize our opportunity in the state related to the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. I'll pause and let Michelle introduce herself as well.
Good morning, and thank you, Chair Long, members of the committee. I am Michelle Grancy. I serve as the director of the Minnesota State Energy Office within the department, and I oversee the Weatherization Assistance Program, the State Energy Program, and a number of other statutorily directed energy programs and policy initiatives. I'll pass it back to Catherine.
Great. So as you can see from this first slide, we were asked to present on the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, otherwise known as the Federal Infrastructure and Jobs Act, or FIJA. And we'll make sure to pay per instruction, make sure we provide information on energy assistance and weatherization related to that. So on this slide, you just see we're going to get into the provisions and specifics related to the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, but just starting with sort of the opportunity, right? What we might realize for this state and for Minnesotans. So we are focusing in this discussion today on the energy side, but as we're thinking about sort of going out for the competitive funding opportunities or utilizing the dollars, we really want to keep in the forefront, how can we achieve these benefits that you see listed right on this slide? And would also note a couple more, obviously building resilience, greater resilience into our electric grid, into our building stock if we can, making sure that we serve all of the state, right? Metro, rural, exurban, right? So even in this early stage, right, as we get information out, as we do engagement, we want to look through that lens. And hopefully, ultimately, we're strategically maximizing the amount of federal dollars for the state, right, that we're getting. Next slide, please. All right. So starting to dig in now on what is in the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act and what does it mean for Minnesota? So again, it's a very historic investment. There are investments outside of energy in roads and bridges, right? In broadband and electric vehicles, right? Related to energy and other areas. So we'll be confined today to the energy related provisions, but really just wanted to acknowledge that sort of unprecedented investment. A couple pieces to note or just level set, the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act is quite different from ERA, right? You guys remember the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act that's, boy, almost 15 years old now, right? Ago, that was an act ERA sort of putting a bunch of money into states through formula. This is sort of the flip, right? We're seeing instead the bulk of the opportunity coming through competitive funding that will be driven obviously by the federal government in terms of detail. So that's a big difference, but it really is. And then I should also note sort of who's eligible, right? We'll try to do at a high level, at least pointing out who's able to apply for these funds. States can be eligible entities, but often private businesses can be, utilities, local units of government. And then I should also note tribes sometimes have their own funding streams that were prescribed right by the act, and sometimes they won't. So that'll be a difference that we need to track. Next slide, please. So we talked about the opportunity. Let's talk about the other side of the coin. The obvious piece to think about, right, always, is that this competitive money is not guaranteed to make it to Minnesota, right? So, you know, looking at the outset on, you know, the minimum requirements, in some cases, there is a state match required in order to receive funding. We'll talk about that as we go into the specifics and the next set of slides. And also want to acknowledge if there is a required match, that can be challenging depending on what your capacity is, right? Particularly for smaller folks. And then I can't say this enough, but the pace at which we can apply, at which we can know even what the opportunity is really dictated by what information is provided by the federal government. Department of Energy has noted that they're standing up upwards of 60 new programs, right? Thanks to this Bipartisan Infrastructure Act, 16 demonstration, 32 deployment programs, they're expanding other programs. And so I'm sure you folks saw there's an energy core that they've stood up. They're hiring 1,000 people. Good news is just last week, the White House published build.gov, which is a great guidebook, right? So this is their attempt across all issue areas to provide sort of that high level. Here are the opportunities. Here's who's eligible to apply. And here's a start to a timeline, right? Now that guidebook does not give, you know, sort of all of the detail needed, right? Again, to know what the application is going to look like, but it's a great start. Next slide, please. So now we're just going to share some quick information on the types of investments the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act makes, right? So here we're starting with grid resilience and reliability. Quick note on the energy security side, our state energy program, that's run out of our state energy office already looks at energy security planning on a regular basis. It's getting a small amount of additional dollars over a number of years that adds to that efforts and also adds some more distribution planning. We always look at energy security. So that's a good piece of the puzzle. And then let's talk grid. So there's a couple of really exciting programs or opportunities coming down the pike. And they're really focused on preventing outages, right? Increasing reliability, and also sort of hardening infrastructure, right? And on a regional basis. So I'll try to keep this brief, but the first program is through the U.S. Department of Energy. It's called the Grid Resilience and Reliability Program. It's a $5 billion total program across the country. 15% state match requirement, and it's a formula funding program. So we're going to see those dollars through Department of Energy, but we have yet to receive really any detail on how much money will be flowing to Minnesota, where it will go. What we do know is in addition to funding flowing to the state to, again, you know, reach those goals of reducing sort of impact to the electric grid, there's a set aside for utilities, for grid operators, for transmission owners. So there's a grant program that stood up with a 30% set aside for small utilities, which is really exciting. So again, we have a lot of details we need to see in order to know and to plan. And then the other large program is a competitive program, again, enhancing our grid resilience and reliability that will also have another state match requirement. And tribes are eligible, states are eligible to go out for those dollars, as well as a couple other folks. And that's, again, to how can we harden our infrastructure, make it more resilient and reliable at the regional level. Next slide, please. Here's a number of programs that really get at how can we lower energy costs for Minnesotans, businesses, schools, and enabling greater access to renewable energy. That first column, all of the bullets you see there, lower energy costs for businesses, homeowners, and renters, that will be a formula funding program. So, programs that we know and are aware of, but we do not have the exact numbers yet on how much money is going to flow to us, right? All we have is sort of estimates based on previous. And we'll go into energy assistance and weatherization in more detail in other programs. That revolving loan fund you see, preliminary estimate, maybe $2 million, and that would be for commercial and residential audits and energy upgrades for businesses, homeowners, so that's great. And then that second column, again, these are block grants. You'll see some of them are distributed by Commerce, some just go directly to cities, and that's really to help them reduce energy use, right? Improve energy efficiency. So that's exciting, and renewable energy will be a eligible use as well. Next slide. So again, for all of these opportunities, what we know about them is preliminary. And we've, again, tried to give you at least the sense of sort of categories of, there's a number of new, and these are, I believe, all competitive, competitive programs where we can get funding to train workers, right? Actually, businesses can apply for funding and other entities, right, for those innovative clean technologies. So that's really exciting, but bill.gov is telling us really just very preliminary information about them. And then, of course, we're going to need, we'll need to have the capacity to actually apply. But some exciting opportunities, right? A few just to highlight here, these energy efficiency training, right? That really is just about increasing the number of folks who are able to do energy audits, right, or to be able to understand and conduct the latest and greatest in building codes. So that's great. Hydrogen Hub has a lot of buzz around it. There's $8 billion total for at least four regional clean hydrogen hubs. And then, as you can see, a number of programs that are targeted at our private sector, right, and really innovating directly through them or through utilities. And then just a quick nod, we're almost done with this broad overview, but that more bucket, right, there is a lot more. There's a clean school bus program, there's lower no emission grants, but we'll try to stay focused on what Commerce is working on, and our sister agencies, of course, have a part to play. Next slide. So just a quick transition, we can move to the next slide, but as we get through this winter season and we want Minnesotans to be warm, safe, and save money, we want to give you a brief update on energy assistance and weatherization. Next slide, please. I know you folks know we have an unprecedented level of federal funding for energy assistance, and we've really acted proactively to try to get the word out, to try to make sure every person who's eligible is aware and not having to choose between paying their energy bill and buying groceries or prescription medication. So we're here to help Minnesotans avoid those kind of choices. We're excited that we can also help pay for water bills this year. And we've increased the amount of funding available for folks. So they've got potentially thousands of dollars of help, depending on their situation. And we can go to the next slide. And now I'll turn it over, to our State Energy Office Director, Michelle Granzi, to give you some brief facts on weatherization.
Thank you, Catherine. So in thinking about the infrastructure bill and the weatherization funding that will come through there, we thought it might be helpful to have just a brief overview on weatherization and where that sits in Minnesota right now. The Weatherization Assistance Program participants sign on to WAP, weatherization statewide. They carry a larger burden for energy costs, typically around 9 to 14% of their total income on home energy versus other households that are at around 3% statewide. In some cases, weatherization participants enter the program with an energy burden of 20 to 30% more of their total income going towards household energy costs. Within the program, the priority is then to serve first homes where there are children, where there's elderly, where there's a person with a disability, as well as those with the highest energy burden or energy use. And two-thirds of participants live in Greater Minnesota. A little bit more then about weatherization in general. Clients receiving services on average receive a one-time investment of about $7,000 in energy savings, health, and safety measures. The investments vary greatly depending on a comprehensive energy audit that utilizes diagnostic tests to ensure that all possible savings are identified and that all activities are cost-effective. Typical weatherization measures will include mechanical work, building shell, electric, water, and health and safety measures. And the benefits are pretty staggering. After weatherization, and this is based on a national survey, so if anything, it may be a bit low, noting our cold climate here. The average annual energy cost savings for a weatherization participant is $283. But in addition to that, the annual decreased out-of-pocket medical expenses sits around $514. And the total health and household-related benefits per unit is about $14,000, twice the investment just on the energy savings alone. That reduces heating consumption by about 18% and electrical consumption by about 7%. Next slide. As I mentioned, the weatherization clients, two-thirds of the participants live in Greater Minnesota. We do serve statewide. Next slide. So despite the success of the program, there are barriers and challenges that the program currently faces based on limitations related to the federal funding. These include activities that cause service to be denied or deferred, as the U.S. Department of Energy can't pay for certain measures. There are challenges that are inherent to having nearly 600,000 households that are eligible with funding serving about 2,000 to 3,000 of these households annually. And the reality that outside of weatherization, some of the same households would benefit from activities such as adding handrails or ramps, addressing radon, or creating hard surfaces to reduce asthma. These are outside the scope of weatherization, but could be done at the same time as the weatherization work if funding allowed. So on the next slide, just highlighting the in order to address some of these barriers and challenges and to scale up the program, the department with leadership from Chair Long, Representative Bierman, and Chair Senjum established an informal weatherization working group in late October of last year. The group met over 7 times in the last few months and are just finalizing a report of recommendations for both the legislature and the department. This is expected to be publicly available next week. So just a teaser, this is coming. Next slide. So back to thinking about funding, one area to highlight is that funding fluctuations cause disruptions in establishing a strong market and subsequently causes workforce shortages. This slide here shows the base funding from the Department of Energy and Health and Human Services, the orange and the gray, respectively. The yellow spike is from the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, or ARRA, and the blue spike is from the American Rescue Plan. So you can see these fluctuations in funding over the years. Next slide. Despite that, in addition, with the advent of the American Rescue Plan funding, Commerce, Weatherization, and Energy Assistance staff worked together to begin addressing any of those program level barriers that more flexible health and human service funds, known as LIHEAP transfer funds, could address. And here's just a list of some of those measures that were added in order to be able to serve more households and serve these households more deeply. Next slide. So finally, this brings us back to the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. We do anticipate funding for weatherization to begin in July of this coming year. That is one of the few areas that DOE has been able to be pretty clear that that's what they anticipate. There is $3.5 billion nationwide. We estimate that will mean about 116 to 144 million, depending on which formula you use, for Minnesota over the course of the next 10 years. However, we need to be aware that the majority of the deferral reasons and the other barriers that I identified will not be able to be addressed by this funding due to the prescribed nature of the US DOE funds. So some of those same homes that are being deferred would still be deferred even with this additional funding. Next slide. So finally, I'm just going to show that same chart, starting now just in 2013 after ARRA. You can see DOE, if we are to receive a constant funding level, what that will look like. The LIHEAP transfer funds at 15% transfer, what that will look like going forward. The ARPA dollars and how those drop off, and then the infrastructure dollars and how we anticipate those flowing. And where that stabilization or funding gap still remains. Next slide. So with that, I'll bring us back up a level with the main takeaways from the entire deck. We are currently facing the largest long-term investment in our infrastructure and competitiveness in nearly a century. Most of the opportunity coming from the Bipartisan Infrastructure Act is in competitive dollars, not formula funding opportunities. However, there are some formula funding opportunities, and we are doing everything in our power to prepare for that. The state will need matching funds in order to get some of those formula dollars, and definitely in order to pursue competitive dollars. What we know about the competitive opportunities overall is somewhat limited, as the federal government needs to dictate rollout and pace those opportunities. But what we can do and are working to do is to get ready, starting the conversations with stakeholders, speaking with the legislature, letting folks know who can apply for grants and work on a compelling scope of work, getting staffing capacity pulled together in order to be responsive and bring in as many dollars as possible. We can share some links to the basic fact sheets in the chat or the build.gov, and we anticipate having more information up on the Commerce's website here in a short time. So finally, just mentioning again, the formula dollars for weatherization will assist in serving more household needs, and yet more is to be done. So with that, we will pass it back to Chair Long for any questions.
Thank you so much. If you have handouts that you'd like us to share with the committee, feel free to give those to us, and we can distribute those and post them on our website. This was really helpful information. I just have two questions to start with. The first is that it looks like, as you outlined, a number of these grant opportunities are competitive, going to require state match dollars, and we don't at this point really know some of the details about what the parameters will be and how we need to apply. For the governor's budget proposal, note that you had, I think, a $25 million, if I'm not mistaken, fund proposed for being able to apply for some of these competitive grants. And just would love it if you could describe a little bit what you all are thinking we might be most competitive for in some of those applications, or which ones you have your eyes on, and how that process might look as you're thinking about maximizing the federal dollars coming to the state. I don't know who'd like to take that.
Chair, I can take that. And for the record, Chair and members, my name is John Kelly. I'm the Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce. In the governor's budget, we have a $20 million change item we're calling the State Competitiveness Fund. This would set aside $20 million, and this is a kind of an estimate by the department of what we would potentially need to not only go out and be competitive as a state, but also assist local units of government, tribal governments in competing for these federal funding opportunities. Also in the change item would be staff that would be able to do the technical work, the applications, and provide that technical assistance to local units of government. We believe that this would position the state to be able to go out and as we get more information, as we get more ideas of the pace from the federal government, we would not have to wait for the legislature necessarily to come back. I think that given the long time horizon, this is probably going to be an ongoing thing that we're going to need to work collaboratively with the legislature on in order to maximize state matching funds and maximize the federal funds that are coming into the state.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kelly. My second question is for Director Grancy. You mentioned that there was some state matching funds that would be needed. Are there state matching funds for any of the items that you went over in terms of the weatherization program or LIHEAP? Or I guess, where do we know that state matching funds would be required in the formula funds aside from the competitive grants?
Thank you, Chair Long. So what we know is weatherization, state energy program, EECBG, none of those at this point require a state match. Where we anticipate state match or know that state match will be needed will be in relationship to the grid resiliency formula funds, which are still to be defined by the federal government. It was a provision that was a little bit undefined in the original act. However, it does say that there's a 15% requirement there. I'm going to pass it on, if I can, to Catherine of any other additional match requirements she's aware of.
Assistant Commissioner Blago.
Thank you, Chair Long. Yes, and indeed on the grid, which is a really exciting opportunity. There is match requirements also on the competitive side. And just want to note, you know, again, we really are waiting for more details to understand. But since there are, you know, very small to large entities that are able to apply, we want to be in a position to also support those entities, right? So that's how we're thinking about it at this point.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. I think, yeah, I'm unmuted. I've got two questions too. The first one I think is for Ms. Blaudette, Blaubelt. And, you know, you talked about electric grid reliability. And obviously anybody who's studied this issue knows that in America, we need to shore up our grid reliability. It's very suspect right now, according to articles I've read. But I just don't see how promoting alternative energy of solar and windmills, which don't provide baseload electricity, versus hydro or nuclear or a natural gas, how this is going to make the grid more resilient. We see California, and we see the results of this type of approach, which is rolling blackouts, high cost, and unreliable electricity for recipients. Appreciate your response on how this alternative energy is going to make the grid more resilient rather than more susceptible to baseload electricity.
Assistant Commissioner Blaubelt on the grid reliability funding from the federal government.
Thank you, Chair Long, and thank you, Representative, for the question. So certainly you're touching on a core tenet of what Commerce works on every day, which is ensuring grid reliability. So we absolutely share that goal. And as we bring on more renewables onto the grid, you know, we're tracking that in a myriad number of ways and are, you know, certainly proud that we do have a large amount of renewables on the grid and are maintaining that and maintaining reliability. What's exciting about this Federal Infrastructure Act opportunity is that it's really a shared conversation. It's not the state, but rather sitting at the table we see with utilities, with local units of government, and really figuring out what does that resilient grid of the future look like. It's about the hardline technology, you know, as at least part of the puzzle. So I'm hoping we can find common ground that's a worthwhile conversation to have and to have with a number of stakeholders.
Representative Gruenhagen.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I have a second question. Thanks for that response, but I just have to disagree that alternative energy is going to create more resiliency with our grid. We're going to have nothing but problems as far as I can see on my research. But the other question I have, you know, when I look at this alternative energy in the past, all I've seen is my electricity rates continue to climb and my electricity rates for my seniors and low-income people continue to climb. Now, I know some people count savings, but, you know, I'm into what actually paying the bill is. I, you know, a few years ago, my electric bill used to be, and I live out in the country and I'm with a co-op that does a great job, but my bill used to be less than $100 some months. And now I'm over pretty regularly over $200 a month. So I don't see where alternative energy is going to reduce my electricity kilowatt charge. In fact, I see it going up, which is exactly what my local co-op tells me. So are we going to subsidize these increases for lower income people, or, you know, how are we going to keep this from producing energy poverty in families? Either Ms. Blavet or Ms. Grancy, whoever would like to take that question. Thank you.
Okay. Assistant Commissioner Blavet, would you like to take a crack at that?
I'd be happy to. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative. We all know living in Minnesota, having heat on, right, is not a nice to have. It's an absolute essential. So again, absolutely agree on the need to be able to afford your energy bill and be able to stay warm and safe in your home. I'd actually point and thank this body and the legislature for working collaboratively with a lot of stakeholders on ECO, right? The ECO Act. The best thing we can do is not use the energy, right? We got to save it first and foremost. So I think that's a building block that, you know, as we in the very cold winter months are helping folks get energy assistance or get more affordable energy efficiency in their home, we can really give some practical, you know, tips. And thanks to ECO, really give people more of an opportunity, right, to have a lower energy bill by simply not using that. So I thank you for that.
Yeah,
Representative Gruenhagen, we're going to need to keep moving.
Yep, sure. Just a final comment. You know, when it was 31 below, I think in 2019, the Star Tribune published an article, which I have a copy of somewhere, and alternative energy provided less than 5% on the grid. So severe cold weather drops the efficiency of these things, which we all know. So I think you're setting us up for a disaster rather than resiliency. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We also know that severe cold weather doesn't do well for any form of energy, be it coal or gas or nuclear in some circumstances. Representative Swazinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just maybe it would be Assistant Commissioner Blah, if she could ask her question. After all the funds are spent, so the federal dollars that'll come in and then the potential matching dollars that will be put together, what's the total dollar amount that we're looking at, both from the federals, you know, and from the federal printing press, and then also from the state?
Assistant Commissioner Blavet.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. So I'd love to know the exact answer to that as much as you would. The competitive funding, obviously, we don't know the answer to that, right? Not knowing how successful we'll be. On the formula funding side, we do not have exact numbers yet. We're anticipating around the ballpark of around $200 million in formula funding, but that is over a number of years, right? This Bipartisan Infrastructure Act runs between 5 and 10 years, depending on the provision of the bill. And I unfortunately can't speak to the matching fund exact number, but we'd hope to be in continued dialogue about those figures.
Representative Smoczynski.
Okay, sounds good. So from my understanding, so we're expecting about at least $200 million come in from the federal government. That's not counting the potential matching dollars that would reap in more.
Mr. Kelly, it looked like you wanted to chime in.
Thank you, Chair, Representative Smoczynski. What we do know, and to echo my colleagues in the Energy Division, is there's a lot of unknowns, but we believe we anticipate 200 in formula funding with a majority in weatherization and 50 million for grid reliability. The rest, as we said in the presentation, is primarily in competitive dollars. And then there's some areas where we have an idea of the percentage of match that will be required by entities or state match. And then the rest, we are continuing to wait for more guidance from DOE.
Okay. And just one final question to
yes, sir, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So let's say $200 million is spent approximately. I mean, we really don't know. Will energy be more expensive or least will the prices for energy go down after all that money is spent?
So the question is, will weatherization help save money? Let's see, Ms. Grancy.
Oh.
Thank you, Chair Long, Representative. So within that total amount of money coming through, we anticipate upwards of 116 to 144 million coming into weatherization. On average, the household energy use is reduced by 20 to 30% or more. So it absolutely will save energy and save dollars for all the participants of the weatherization program.
Thank you, Director Grancy. Representative Bierman. Representative Smoczynski.
Just one last quick comment too. Sorry.
Briefly.
Just in reply to that, you know, I know businesses that have gotten energy efficiency dollars from the state, and they've been doing it for 10 years. And while your statement says that they will save this amount of money, the problem is they're, right now these entities are using half the amount of energy they used to by changing pumps and changing motors, but their price is twice as high. So the cost of energy is going up faster than the money you're going to actually save by these things actually moving through. And if that's the direction we're going, we're really not gaining people anything. If we could hold energy prices the same, that would be one thing. But we're spending money on inefficiency, but cost is just that much higher. So I think our goal needs to be two-pronged. We're actually reduce the cost of energy and also save energy so people can move forward.
Representative Bierman.
Thank you, Chair Long. Thank you for the presentation. And just to follow up on Representative Smoczynski, I think that working towards energy efficiency and energy reduction on savings is huge, but the better part of it is the lower cost of renewables in the longer term. So, I mean, I see that on my own house with solar. And the energy savings are in renewables as well as weatherization. And I wanted to thank Commissioner Gramsci and Ms. Blauvelt for the good introduction on the weatherization side of this conversation. And my question goes right to that again. I believe you had said 116 to 144. That's a pretty big swing. And I wondered what factors make that number go up or down for Minnesota in this amount of funding, please.
Director Gramsci.
Thank you, Chair Long, Representative. So why there is that kind of wide swing is that all we have been told to date is it's $3.5 billion that will be distributed among the 56 states and territories. And so the low number is what we are estimating based on our current the current flow of funds. The higher number is what's estimated by other outside entities and what it's, there's two different formulas that the Department of Energy uses. And so we're using the more conservative one. Others are looking at it with the higher formula. So that's why there's such a range. Once Department of Energy releases their guidance, we'll find that exact amount.
Thank you, Director Kranzi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One follow-up. Appreciate that. And again, appreciate, you know, just knowing that that money is coming is great, but, and it seems like a lot of money, but spread over 10 years. And as the committee will learn when we do the weatherization proposal, the need is so great in Minnesota that we have a lot more work to do in that area across the state. Just one other question, please, on the revolving loan fund. I think you said that was a $2 million fund. Is that something that every state is granted, or is that something we have to compete for as well? And then also just, if you could quickly just mention if charging stations are involved in any of these funds, or if we can get an overview of that as well, please.
So on the charging stations, we're going to have a separate hearing where we'll get a chance to dig into that funding stream. But Assistant Commissioner Blavel on the revolving loan.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative, for the question. I'll lead off and hand it to Director Kranzi, but that revolving loan fund, which is for sort of commercial and residential audits and energy upgrade, that should simply be coming to us. Although we're still estimating that $2 million. Over to you, Director Kranzi.
Director Kranzi.
Sorry. Thank you, Chair Long, Representative. So we do anticipate around $2 million. That is a formula that would go out to all states and territories. So we're basing that on the state energy program formula, assuming they use the same one. Again, that could vary depending on what the Department of Energy utilizes. That is the one formula that is coming through that is a new program. Everything else expands or builds upon either existing or rebooting in the case of the Energy Efficiency Community Block Grant Program. The revolving loan fund is new. We anticipate a long lag time before that will come into play.
Representative Lee will have the last question, and then we'll have to move on to our bill. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for hopping on. And so, as you may know, this morning we have MMB come and present in capital investment. And one question that I have of the amount that Commerce is going to receive from the feds for the federal infrastructure bill, do you know what amount is tied to Congress passing a budget resolution? For example, we have heard that transportation of the amount transportation is going to receive about $500 million may not be released until there's a new resolution. And so could you tell us if there's a figure or an amount for Commerce?
Assistant Commissioner Blavel.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the question. We are in a different boat than that particular appropriation you referenced. So the amounts and the sort of programs we discussed are not contingent on that future approach. It is passed and now law, and we're waiting on implementation.
Representative Lee, looks like you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. All right. Well, thank you so much to our Commerce friends for coming and giving that very helpful presentation today. And we will be in touch, I'm sure, as the session continues and we know more about the funding streams, about how we can maximize our state opportunities. Thank you. I'm now going to hand the virtual gavel over to Vice Chair Akam for our bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Would you like to go ahead and introduce your bill?
Yes, so I would like to move that House File 2875 be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. I had misspoken earlier to Representative Swazinski about moving to the General Register. I think with the amendment, there is a need for a Ways and Means stop, but hopefully it will get to the General Register soon.
Great. And then, Mr. Chair, would you like to introduce your author's amendment, coded A1?
Yes, so the A1 would correct a technical error in the past appropriation language that was flagged for us by fiscal staff. The original bill didn't have a base, so the tails weren't appropriately corrected. So this is needed for the funds to be appropriated.
Great. Any questions on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. The amendment is adopted. Representative Long, tell us about your bill.
Thank you so much, Vice Chair Yacoum. So members will recall the really innovative and exciting Prairie Island Net Zero project that we have funded in previous years. We have Blake Johnson here from Prairie Island to discuss the status update on the Net Zero project. But this bill is really simple. It's the A1 amendment that we discussed to fix the fiscal appropriation issue. And then we also needed to allow Prairie Island additional time to complete the RFP process. When we are in the middle of COVID, it's been difficult, I think, to keep things on the timelines that we had expected previously. So we're just giving some additional time and not requiring that the money roll back at this point and have more opportunity for the RFP process to continue. So with that, Vice Chair Yacoum, if we could welcome Blake Johnson to the committee, I would appreciate it.
Great. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Johnson. If you could introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. So, Mr. Johnson, I'm seeing your slides, but not hearing you. Could you be muted?
There we go. Got to figure it out.
Great.
Hihani Warshite, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House Energy Committee. My name is Blake Johnson. My Indian name is Hokshita Mazawambali, which is Iron Eagle Boy. I'm the State Government Relations Specialist for the tribe and also a tribal member. What I'm here to do today is just give you an update on where we sit for the Net Zero Project and what you see on the screen. I hope you guys are able to see this. Awesome. This is the report from July 1st, 2021, plus just a little updated to where we sit today. The Net Zero Energy Community report for July 1st, 2021. As you recall, back when this legislation was passed, House Bill 1842 was to develop an energy system that results in net zero emissions. The Prairie Island Indian community must file a comprehensive project plan with the Commissioner of Commerce and the Legislative Committees, which jurisdiction over energy policy no later than July 1st, 2021. And that is something that we did already do. We've put this into three different phases. Phase one was to engage our community, get stakeholder engagement, technical analysis, and then project plan development. That phase one has been completed, and we've been working hard to make sure this is a community-based effort and showing what we want to see in the future. Phase two is project costing and the vendor selection. With this bill and what we were supposed to submit by January 1st, 2021 or 2022 has been delayed. And I'll go into that a little bit more with this PowerPoint. Phase three, construction and implementation. That is towards the end of the project, and when construction starts, the annual reports are due, like I said, July 1st every year until completion of the project. The path to net zero. In phase one, our goal was to establish a vision, a baseline, and create priorities for our community. And then it goes into weighing our options and costs and then implementing the plan. When we establish a vision, our goal is to achieve the energy sovereignty and sustainability engagement, engage in our membership, and make sure that this is a community-based effort and showing that not only is this going to benefit our people, but our future generations and our young children that are here today is the ones that is going to benefit more. Evaluate the baseline and trying to understand exactly how much power we use and how much carbon we use annually. I will go through those and show you exactly what we actually use every year. Creating priorities, focusing on the energy efficiency, renewable generation, and then energy resiliency and sovereignty. And then that all leads into weighing our different options and the cost of the project. And then finally implementing the plan. The path to net zero. Establishing the vision, the stakeholder engagement piece, like I said, is huge for us. You know, it's trying to figure out what this means to our community and our culture and how this affects all of our community. To achieve energy sovereignty and sustainability while engaging our membership, fostering innovation and honoring the past and focusing on the next seven generations to create a balance with Ina Maka, which is Mother Earth. These values that we see are born of the waters with the wisdom, peace and calm, self-dependence, equality, generosity and foundation, and then the guiding principles of protecting Mother Earth in engaging the members. And those different types of things are the main focus of what we want to do to become net zero. And then establishing the baseline. What we did is went back to 2019, pre-COVID, and when everything was operational, and everything was open at 100%. And went back to 2019 to see our energy use and emissions, the buildings and purchase utilities, such as our Treasure Island Resort Casino, tribal government buildings, including off-reservation buildings, and then tribal residences. Our fleet vehicles, we looked at the Treasure Island Resort Casino, tribal government, and then water usage from the Prairie Island plant, water plant. And what came about that is what we've seen is just over 20 million pounds of carbon emissions annually. 82% of that is from our casino and hotel resort. As you can see, that takes up most of our power and our uses is that it's less open 24/7. And so what we did is just as a visual that hones into our membership is that we deal with railroad tracks that go across the only way on and off a reservation. So we put this little picture and little note in here that 20 million pounds of CO2 annually is equivalent to 75 oil tanker cars. And then once we figured that out, the next step was to implement the plan, come up with ideas on what we can do. And when we went to this, we were open-minded and made sure that we could at least leave every option on the table to see what we could do to be innovative and to show that communities like us can do something like this and look at all these different efforts. And what came about was 46 projects that were based on the estimated cost and ability to maximize our CO2 reduction and focusing on the energy efficiency, electrification, and generation. As you can see, it says just under $42 million invested. And then the energy efficiency side, we looked at the LED lighting, electrifying their fleet, and the ground source heat pump. Generation is the solar arrays, and resiliency and sovereignty is the operations economic development. These dates here on the cycles 1, 2, and 3 for the actual construction of the project are going to be changed back, moved back because of the delay on getting construction companies to bid in our RFP process, as was explained earlier. In cycle one, you can see the total is about $14.4 million. The big ticket item on this one is that heat recovery ground source heat pump well field. We're working on the energy efficiency side, and then the generation is the self-facing solar thermal. And then you move into cycle two, which, like I said, is going to be pushed back a year or so. That total is $16.1 million. A lot of the funds that the main fund for this one is the heat recovery ground source, the balance of the plant. It was in, so that's what it in cycle two is $16.2 million. When you move down to cycle three, the grand total is just under $12 million. Working on the electrification and generation side. The big ticket items here are the two large solar arrays that were for the business side and our residential side. And from this project here, the reduction in emissions, we reduce our carbon footprint by 19.4 million. So there's just 0.5 million left after these projects are completed and we're fully operational. This is gets us to pretty much 100% in achieving our net zero goal and focusing in on making sure that we help move forward with that along the way, as well as planting vegetation and all different types of options to make up for any other carbon usage. The Prairie Island Net Zero Project phase 2 and 3 are delayed because of the new global realities. This is something that was kind of explained by Chair Long. And, you know, the increased costs, the supply chain issues and labor shortages. And with our new global realities, the cost of, for this project has risen dramatically due to COVID. Steel's up 31%, copper's up 52%, aluminum is up 66%. Polysilicon is up 220%. And not only along those lines, the labor cost and availability is visual, and you can definitely see that as well in regards to these projects. The prices are expected to hold or increase through 22 and begin to normalize more in 2023 from what we've been seeing. So this approach would change our certified cost report from January 1st, 2022 to January 1st, 2023. Our tribe thinks that's the best interest to do this, not only for us to complete the project, but also use the state funds appropriately and to achieve our goal of becoming net zero. And when we go down along these lines, we did issue an RFP as we were moving forward to meet that January 1st deadline that was originally set. We did run into the problem with getting multiple bids to come in. We did have a lot of interest from different bidders, but the actual bids that did come in was pretty minimal. And so what we decided and what we took an approach in looking to see what could work, and that is moving to the four RFPs versus the one, you know, and kind of separating into four different categories: commercial renewable energy, commercial electrification, and then commercial energy efficiency and all the residential side. And as you can see, starting in March, June, and August, these are where these RFPs are going to be issued and start to get these put in place so that we can meet that new January 1st, 2023 deadline. And that's all I have today. I'm able to take any questions, Madam Chair, if anybody has any.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Thank you for the presentation and the update. And it looks like Representative Grunhagen has a question.
Okay, all right. See you. Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, the question I have, appreciate the presentation from Mr. Johnson. Did we get an accountability of the last 16 or 15 million that we gave in 2021? What happened to that money?
Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Grunhagen. We have taken a portion of that money and has gone into the initial work that to bring on a company who is Indian Energy, and who also has sub-licensed with Chief Strategy Group and NV5 to do that initial work. So we have taken a portion of that. We haven't used most of that to date. That still sits within the Commerce Department, but we have taken portions of it to get to where we are right now.
So, Mr.
Yeah, Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, just for clarification then, so this is additional money on top of the what you have left yet there? And it, you know, I just, when I look at some of the things we've done in this state, we've wasted millions of dollars on certain projects like Minlars, and I could go on and on. It's just troubling to me that we gave 16 million, and evidently I thought that was supposed to take care of it, and now they want another, what is it, 20 million? You know, I was raised on the farm. It smells a little bit like a skunk in the wood pile, but tell me why that's not true.
Representative Grunhagen, it looks like Mr. Eloff has raised his hand. He may have something to say about your math.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the original legislation for the Net Zero Project, which says that the Prairie Island Indian community must file a report with the Commissioner of Commerce and the legislative committees with jurisdiction over energy policy on July 1, 2022, and each July 1st thereafter until the project is complete, describing the progress made in implementing the project and the uses of expended funds. So we should see a report on what the money's been used for so far on July 1st.
Okay.
Gotcha.
Well, thank you.
Chair Long, did you have something to add?
I just wanted to note to Representative Grunhagen, we're not appropriating any additional funding today in this bill. These are funds that have already been appropriated by the legislature. And as Mr. Elef pointed out, we have accountability and reporting measures that have been put in place. All we're doing is trying to be responsive to the circumstances on the ground with regard to the timeline for the project. And then also trying to help with the technical language around the appropriation for the out years.
Yeah, thank Madam Chair.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, thanks for that correction, Chair Long. And now that you say that, I remember that we're just extending it there. But, you know, you sit on these committees and pass millions and billions of dollars, and a lot of it seems between OLA and the other reports, I'm just glad that we've got some accountability on this. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Representative Grunhagen. Mr. Johnson, did you have anything to say in response?
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I think one thing to note is that all of our reporting covers the costs and expenses that we have used to this point. So it's all in that report as well.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Any other questions from the committee? I'm not seeing anyone. I turn it back to Chair Long for any final comments.
Thank you so much. I would just urge member support and renew my motion that House File 2875, as amended, be re-referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
All right. And let's see, Representative Long renews his motion. And we take a vote. I'm forgetting the exact words for that, but the chair votes aye.
Representative Long.
Aye.
Minority Leader Smaczynski.
Aye.
Representative Bierman.
Aye.
Representative Bo.
Aye.
Representative Christensen.
Aye.
Representative Franson.
Aye.
Representative Grunhagen.
Aye.
Representative Hollins.
Aye.
Representative Hornstein.
Aye.
Representative Igo.
Igo, aye.
Representative Lee.
Lee, aye.
Representative Lippertz.
Aye.
Representative Lislegard.
Lislegard, aye.
Representative Mecklund.
Aye.
Representative Munson. Representative Munson. Representative Stevenson. Representative Stevenson.
There being 15 ayes and 2 absence, the bill passes and we'll head to Ways and Means. With that, I get to hand the gavel back to Chair Long.
Phew. Thank you so much, Vice Chair Aiken. So members, we have one more presentation for us this meeting, and that is from Professor Richard Graves. I was the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research. And just so members recall, last year we passed a requirement in our energy omnibus bill for a report on the potential for the state to look at bike lane provisions. And the report was just published last week, so hot off the presses. And so I'm excited to welcome Professor Graves back to the committee to walk through the findings.
Great. Thank you, Chair Long and members of the committee. My name is Richard Graves, and I'm the director of the Center for Sustainable Building Research at the University of Minnesota. Let me share my screen. Go to the next slide. So the report that was requested by this committee on construction materials environmental impact study. Basically, the research had 4 items in its scope. It was to look at overall. It was to look at an overview of low environmental impact material policies and the use of environmental product declarations in procurement policies. There'll be some acronyms in this presentation. I apologize for that. So if I say EPDs, I mean environmental product declarations. So the scope of the report looked at 4 things. One was a review of type 3 environmental product declarations for 4 types of materials: concrete, masonry, metal and wood. I'll explain what a type 3 EPD is. A review and summary of programs in other states and countries. That's in the report. I won't go through that, but you can get more information by reviewing the report. And then we also did a feasibility study, looked at economic costs and environmental benefits for instituting a Buy Clean policy, and then came up with policy recommendations. So a little bit of context. So the Buy Clean policy really looks at, and when we were talking about environmentally preferable materials, we're really talking about reducing the energy use and embodied carbon, and therefore embodied carbon used in creating building materials. And so a little bit of context. So the building sector is responsible for about 30% of the carbon in the economy, 20% for building operations, 8% from building materials, and then another 2% that's sort of tracked in industry and waste emissions. And then when we talk about embodied carbon, what we're really talking about is, as we're building buildings, what's the energy use and resulting carbon from extracting raw materials, manufacturing those materials into products that we can use in the built environment, in building the construction and energy used in the construction process to build the building, the maintenance, replacement, and repair materials over the life of the building, and then deconstructing, and then the waste of those materials. Those are all tracked as embodied carbon, which is different from the operational carbon that we track in other ways and make improvements in other ways in the built environment. And so, you know, overall, if you look at the kind of 30-year life cycle of a building, what we're talking about with embodied carbon is, as you're building a new building or doing a major renovation addition,
Were you intending to share slides?
Sorry. Let's see here. There we go. Can you see that now?
Yes, now we can. If you could go to the presentation view.
Yeah, we won't. There we go. Thank you.
There we go. Excellent.
So let me go back just to show. So this is the chart showing the kind of 30% where embodied carbon is in the sector, and then embodied carbon across the different life cycles of building design and construction. So if you look, so here's a graph that I was describing. Sorry about not sharing the presentation properly. So if you look at carbon over the 30-year life cycle of building, the initial bars show the large upfront embodied carbon and energy used in building a building that's kind of in year zero as you initially build a new building or do a major renovation addition. The light blue bars show the carbon usage or the carbon generation over time from operating the building and using energy to heat and cool and do other things in the building. And then there'll be the potential for other embodied carbon over the life of the building as you replace materials or do other things over time. And so the embodied carbon, there are different strategies to address the carbon footprint of buildings. Whole building life cycle assessments and Buy Clean can address the embodied carbon part of the life of a building's impact. And what we're already doing with the Sustainable Building 2030 program is what we're doing to address the operational carbon. So in terms of scope of projects, any policy, the bonded projects could potentially address by integrating within B3 the initial embodied carbon by integrating requirements within the B3 process. That would affect the state-funded construction within bonding. It's up to this committee and the legislature if that scope should be expanded to address other types of projects other than state-funded projects. And then also another scope question is, how would you address projects that are about maintenance and upgrading and replacing materials over time that could be included in a buy clean policy or reducing embodied carbon. In addition, you know, just to highlight a couple of things to give some context, there's two ways that or two types of guidelines that we can reduce embodied carbon in the built environment. One is through whole building life cycle assessments that allows you to affect the decisions in pre-design of what kind of structure you're using, reducing the use of materials in the building and design to get embodied carbon reductions. Once those design decisions and pre-design decisions are made in the design and construction phases, once materials have been selected, a buy clean policy allows you to pick better materials or materials that have less embodied carbon. And then one last bit of context, and I'll give you an overview of the report and answer questions. So a couple of definitions. Again, environmental product declarations are the way that we track these emissions and products. That standard is set by the International Standards Organization. And there are different types of environmental product declarations. Type 3 declarations are preferred because they're third party certified and verified to be able to compare one product versus another. So in our report, we did a scan of the number of environmental product declarations geographically and also by different product category. If you look at right now, Minnesota manufacturers rank about 15th in terms of the total number of environmental product declarations, with large numbers of products certified either in California, Oregon, Washington, or New York, New Jersey. This is the result of buy clean policies in these other states that are requiring environmental product declarations for some of their state-funded construction, which then increase the number of manufacturers creating those declarations in their products. In addition, there's sort of an uneven amount of environmental product declarations by product category, with a large number of EPDs in concrete, because we have a lot of those declarations by ready mix mix and by concrete plant, where the EPDs in other industries like wood are industry level environmental product declarations, not at the individual product. So that's something to keep aware of in developing a policy. So in terms of feasibility, costs, and benefit, in terms of feasibility, there's an increasing use of EPDs by states and municipalities, and then potentially the federal government. So they're becoming more common for products every day. There's a clear, you know, clear submission process is required to have rigor in any policy, so that you get submissions for actual products and can verify those for each individual building project. And the data is improving over time, but it's uneven for some materials. The example between concrete and wood that I gave before. In terms of cost, there are a number of costs that could be incurred by creating a policy. For at the state level, there's potentially some cost for creating a reporting database and then having staffing to review submissions and track submissions, though there's also the potential to reduce or mitigate some of those costs by collaborating with other municipalities and states who are doing similar efforts. There's a potential cost for material suppliers to hire consultants to create environmental product declarations for their products. And then there's a cost in the design and construction industry for the time required to include those EPDs with material submissions during the construction process. Those challenges come with some economic benefits. Competitive advantages for suppliers and design firms by creating these EPDs, as they become increasingly requested by municipalities and other states that are creating buy clean policies requiring these EPDs. The other thing is that the environmental product declarations often lead to, because they're tracking energy usage and carbon in the manufacturing process, they spotlight potential energy efficiency and process improvements in Mac manufacturing that can evolve into savings for manufacturers. And in terms of environmental benefits, state construction could save up to 295,000 metric tons of carbon by instituting these policies in a reduction in carbon in the construction materials used for state construction. And then those reductions in state construction could affect materials used for all construction. In terms of policy recommendations, we outlined in the report the components that should be included in any policy of scope, data disclosure, compliance, and standards and incentives. Creating standards and incentives, those are often phased in over time if we look at policies in other jurisdictions. In terms of strategies to create a policy, our recommendations are start simply and start with a short list of the more high impact materials, concrete, for example. Engage stakeholders in the process, because other jurisdictions have seen that reduces costs by engaging stakeholders, and it also improves compliance over time. And then as much as possible, align with existing frameworks and tools. And then again, the state construction improvements could affect the private sector projects in terms of getting reductions there. So in terms of next steps in creating a policy would be establishing goals to get some more specifics of the goals the state would be trying to achieve in any BioClean policy. We really recommend having a stakeholder process with material suppliers, manufacturers, the construction industry agency, and others to help work through how a policy would develop, and thereby reducing costs and improving compliance. And then ultimately, the last step would be coming up with a policy design. What would be the scope of it? How would you staff it? And then how would you phase it in over time? So with that, I'll stop sharing and I can answer any questions.
Thank you so much for that report. That's very helpful. We will go to member questions first. And first up, we have Representative Lislegard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for the study. There is obviously a lot to unpack here. And I think as we move forward in trying to create a policy that makes sense and is sustainable moving forward, that stakeholder engagement is going to be extremely important. The last thing that the state wants to do is create unfunded mandates on businesses I don't want to say it's overreaching, but it's so cumbersome, and then it affects their ability to be effective from a cost-benefit ratio for our business. The whole goal for Buy Clean, Buy Fair is to truly understand where these minerals or where these products are coming from, and the impact that it has not only in our state or our country, but more globally. And so, I don't have any answers now. I just know that when we start to talk about creating a policy, we have to do our due diligence to make sure that we're setting it up for success. And so I wanna thank you for this. I think that it'll take us time to create the right policy, but I look forward to working on it. Thank you.
Professor Graves, do you have any comments?
No, thank you. I agree with those points. So.
Okay. Representative Eichel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Professor Graves, for the presentation and the report. The biggest thing that I kind of saw, and it's kind of going off what Representative Lislegard was talking about, is really kind of getting into we talked a lot about the embodiment of carbon in these buildings. But we didn't really talk about a lot of stuff that's going to go into that. And a lot of that was with the acquisition, right? Whether it be wood products, whether it be mining materials, the carbon impact that those carry with them, where they're being sourced right now. But the real big thing is the lifespan of a lot of those materials that you're going to put into those future builds, right? What is the lifespan right now of a solar panel? What is the lifespan of a charging station? What's the lifespan of an electric car, right? And the thing is that the lifespan on a solar panel is only 3 to 5 years. And you're taking it out of the ground in Africa and bringing it across the ocean. That carbon impact is way, way larger than anything we're trying to accomplish with this study. So I guess my question to you is, was that stuff looked at? Because even when we're talking about building materials, just wood products, right? How much of our wood products comes from Canada and comes down on trucks or trains, right? That's a carbon impact right there when we could be sourcing it all right here. And I say it almost every committee hearing when it comes to copper, nickel, and even steel production, right? We need to be making sure we're doing that here in Minnesota with the best environmental standards and the best labor standards to limit that CO2 impact, right? So we can embody as much as possible for the least amount, rather than being, you know, funding consumerism demand around the world where there is no standard for that. So is that something that's going to be looked at in this report?
So I'll just wanted to correct the record on solar panels. The life cycle, lifespan is 25 to 30 years, not 3 to 5. But Professor Graves on the question from Representative Biden.
Yeah, thank you, Representative, for the question. So the transportation impacts, so where raw materials are extracted, where the production happens, and then the transportation is included in the life cycle assessment. One of the challenges that we have is it depends upon the industry, how detailed they are in tracking that at the exact location of manufacture. Versus other industries. So the intent, so the point you're making is the goal of the assessment is to get it down to the actual production level so that you can track the advantages of local materials, less transportation versus materials being shipped around the world and reduce those transportation impacts.
Representative Igo, did you have a follow-up?
Not really. Like I said, I just think what this report should show, is how important it is for, you know, not only Minnesota, but the United States as a whole to practice American exceptionalism and make these materials here. Because I don't care where it came from, what industry, you put it on an ocean liner, put it across the ocean, it's going to defeat everything that we're trying to accomplish here.
Thank you, Representative Lago. And I couldn't agree more about American exceptionalism. And I had the opportunity to tour the Cleveland Cliffs direct reduction plant in Toledo, the invitation of Representative Lissagard, where they make steel using all Minnesota iron ore and have achieved a 50% carbon reduction compared to traditional steel methods. So I think we do have some good examples of where the embodied carbon successes can come from Minnesota industry and Minnesota businesses in terms of having a real leg up in terms of the carbon impact. The question I had for you, Professor Graves, is in terms of the ability to acquire some of these certifications, it looks like a number of the states where the businesses had pursued those were probably because there was a state standard in place or there was an incentive to do that. And I'm just curious for some of the larger companies that are operating in and around Minnesota, I would assume a number of those are competing internationally and may have some certifications. You pointed out that there are already a couple hundred in Minnesota on the cement side, or on the concrete side, excuse me. But I'm curious if you could talk about what the process would be for a company that wanted to go through getting a certification. And I know that some states that have implemented BiClean have also had hardship exemptions for smaller companies and other companies. And I don't know if you're familiar with those or if you'd speak to that as well.
Thank you, Representative, for the question. So the process that a company would go through is they would hire a consultant to create the environmental product declaration for their particular product or a suite of products. The cost range that we list in the report for that is about $20,000 to $30,000. Again, that comes with generally they find process improvements in the development and manufacturing of those products to make up for that. So two challenges. One is in the report we talk about once a state comes up with a policy requiring it for their procurement, generally it takes 2 to 3 years for the industry to kind of gear up, get the declarations to be ready to submit to go in. So that will require developing a timeline to phase in requirements to allow industry to kind of get their capacity up and running to be able to submit. There is a challenge for small manufacturers to have the, to be able to afford that cost to develop those environmental product declarations. So some jurisdictions have created incentive programs or small manufacturer reimbursements to do some of that work.
Thanks, that's helpful. Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Long. So what I kind of took out of this thing, and this is a question for Mr. Graves, I'm actually encouraged to see that you're tracking the front side of the process, both in the manufacturing and what it takes to actually make all this happen for energy efficiency and everything and the lifelong process of it all. Because we've been working on this in the building industry for a long time, whether it's ICFs or SIPS panels and all kinds of things to lower energy usage for buildings, whether they're commercial or residential. Are you taking into account the carbon, the manufacturing carbon footprint on the renewable products as well? For what it cost, how much carbon does it take to actually build a wind turbine? How much carbon does it take to actually build and ship a solar panel? Is all that being factored into the return on investment within that 25 to 30 years, as Chair Long mentioned, for like a solar panel, for example? Is that all being factored into the equations and the study in this thing?
So the, sorry.
I'll just note, Representative Mecklen, that the legislature set the scope for the study and had specific products that we requested. But Professor Grace.
Yeah, thank you, Representative. So the scope of the study had us focus on concrete, masonry, metal, and wood as the materials to focus on in this study.
Representative Mecklen.
Thank you, Chair Long, which I understand, but it takes a lot of steel to build a wind turbine. It takes a lot of things to do a lot of this. Footings within the solar arrays to hold the panels up. So are those factors being factored into all this when we're talking about energy efficiency? Because that's the whole goal. So are those equations being put into it as well?
Professor Graves.
So if you take a building project that would be occurring, if it had, say, a solar array on the site, because our scope is concrete, masonry, metal, and wood, the concrete footings for the solar array would be accounted for in the environmental product declarations. The structure, whether it would be steel, masonry, or metal for the array, would be accounted for in the environmental product submissions. I think it's a bit of going forward, what's the potential benefit and impact for the metal and say the solar panels to be included. It sometimes gets difficult to separate small products like the metal in the solar panel versus getting the metal for the structure, et cetera. So I apologize, it's somewhat of a complicated answer, but it's really taking the scope of the four materials and trying to look at separating out for the individual things that go into building the entire building or facility that's getting state-funded construction, so.
Representative Mecklen, any follow-up? And then we're gonna have to go to Representative Lee.
No, thank you, Chair Long. I think that answered my question.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Mecklen. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Director Graves, for coming by to present on the report. Can you speak a little bit to, in conducting and drafting the report, are other states using this? I think I'm intrigued with regards to what you're saying around right now for state bonded projects. We have the B3 program. Other states actually looking at bioclean for their states, and how is that impacting their decision-making process with regards to state-funded construction projects for their built environment?
Professor Graves.
Yeah, so thank you, Representative, for the question. So we outlined a number of, a number of states. I'd have to go to the report for the exact number, but it's something like 6, 7, 8 states that have various bioclean policies. Some of them are new policies that just passed in their last sessions. So they're developing their policies and integrating them in with their state-funded construction process. The two states, California and Washington, have had policies in place for a while, and we've started to see their policies roll out. They're doing various things in terms of how does it affect state-funded construction. Some states are looking at giving incentives within the bid for not only do you look at price, but you look at kind of reductions in embodied carbon when reviewing bids. And then others are just rolling out a reporting requirement for environmental product declarations for these products in state funded construction. So Minnesota compared to other states, almost all the other states are rolling out bi-clean policies, which are really reducing the impact of embodied carbon as you're buying products. We're the only state that we already have in our B3 guidelines a whole building review of embodied carbon and to reduce that in pre-design. And I think over time, states are going to need both policies to really have impact in this space. So we're ahead of many states by doing the pre-design reduction review. And a bi-clean policy will have us kind of fill in the other components like other states are starting to roll out. Hopefully that answers your question.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think this is a great product that maybe we should consider bringing into and have a discussion in capital investment too. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lee. Thank you so much, Professor Graves, for joining us today and for the hard work on this very comprehensive report. I think it's going to be very informative for our work this session.
Great, thank you.
Members, we are back here on Thursday where we're going to have a hearing on our transmission system. And so with that, the meeting is adjourned.